You're listening to Campus Review Radio.
Welcome to HeadX, hosted by Martin Betts. This podcast explores the changing landscape of the higher education sector. Welcome to the Higher Education Experience.
Well, it's great to be back in the HeadX studio, everybody, and the week of our very exciting conference in Melbourne, where we've got an imminent filling of the Melbourne Museum Lecture Theatre. It's about to be full of sector leaders and out-of-sector best practice proponents from Australia and around the world. And I'm really thrilled that we're going to have a full house for the event and pleased to have found a way for a live stream to now be made available for those unable to secure a seat or get to Melbourne. And one of the many guests that I'm looking forward to talking with live and on stage at Melbourne is Josh Nestor of Seek Investments, which is a lovely segue to the guest that we've got on the podcast this week, who is Mike Iljinski of Seek Investments. And Mike is currently the managing director of the education business at Seek Investments. Mike spent 13 years at Seek itself in a variety of roles, culminating as the chief executive officer of Asia Pacific and the Americas. And while at Seek, Mike served as a director of IDP education for 9 years and was very heavily involved in the founding and the startup of OES, no stranger to us on the HeadX podcast. Michael was also the CEO of Redbubble Limited from 2021 to 2023, and has also worked in a number of different places, including McKinsey & Company, Tabcorp, and here's one that I'm sure we're going to talk about, the Collingwood Football Club. Michael holds a Bachelor of Commerce and a Bachelor of Science degrees from the University of Melbourne. He's got an MBA from the Kellogg School at Northwestern University. And with some army roots there as well, is a graduate of the Royal Military College, Duntroon. Mike, a very warm welcome to the HeadX podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on, Martin. It's terrific to be here.
It's terrific to have you. And we're going to hear a lot more from you straight after this message from our sponsors, OES.
Short on resources to enhance your university's online learning objectives? OES's collaborative approach ensures program success while offering flexibility across disciplines. Our tailored solutions uphold academic rigour and your reputation. Choose OES for adaptable, high-quality online learning experiences.
So, Mike, you've got a really rich and varied professional story that I've told a little bit about in that bio, ranging through the Australian Army, dare I call it the Magpie Army, the groves, if we see them, of that of Australian universities, and the world of venture capital and edtech investments. So it's such a diverse group of settings. As I say it out loud to myself, I don't know if it feels diverse to you. And I wonder if you can help explain what set you on the path and journey that you've taken, and how have those quite different, it would appear to an outsider, phases of your career shape the way that you've arrived in your current role and the perspective that you're now bringing to the current opportunities in global learning?
Look, thanks, Martin. It might not quite seem it, but across my journey, and the question sort of caused me to reflect a little bit, there has been a through line of education, technology and leadership. My background, I grew up in the outer northern suburbs of Melbourne here in Australia, very working class. I actually went to a government technical school from year 7 to 10, and I'm not sure if you're aware what they are, but technical schools were set up to really train apprentices, to take, you know, young boys and train them up to be apprentices, and then they would leave at 16. And that's what I actually did for the first 4 years of my high school. But I was actually quite a bit of a nerd, and that didn't particularly suit me very well. So education for me was very much a way out or a way forward, compared to, the surroundings that I was growing up in. And I was very fortunate that my dad was a school teacher. He was a maths and science teacher. He volunteered to teach basic computing when that was just coming out in the late 80s. So we were very lucky that despite not really being able to afford it, we always had a computer in the house, a basic Apple II or an early Mac. So I discovered a love of tech quite early. And then I managed to, do my last couple of years at a high school. At a high school, I was fortunate to get into commerce and science at Melbourne, as you said. And then the military was really a way for me to take a year off study, but more importantly, to be able to support myself through university and take the load off my parents. But university and becoming an officer in the army opened the door to McKinsey. McKinsey opened the door to further education through an MBA in the US, which again, I would never have been able to do on my own if not for that support from McKinsey. And then that ended up leading me to Seek. And then Seek is just this, you know, was this amazing organization that allowed me to combine my strategy, technology, and leadership experiences to help build education and technology businesses. So it was a very much a series of fortunate events, but you can see that through line of the impact of education on my life and then the importance of technology underneath it.
I can certainly see a through line there. I'm taken by your family background there and your picture of how important parents are in showing us the way and being part of that journey. That's been very much my story too. And that through line through a number of different seasons, you might almost call them, of different sorts of organizations is one that I'm intrigued by. I'd love to probe a little bit more about that. I knew Peter Arneson as the former head of the Australian Army and Chancellor of the university that I worked in for a long time at QUT. I was really taken aback when he said this on so many occasions to so many staff at QUT, that he described the two institutions of the Australian Army and QUT as being very similar, which that horrified most of the academics in Brisbane that I worked with, because I imagine the culture of the Australian Army and an Australian young, new entrepreneurial university to be very different. But how do you see the differences in culture between all these places you've worked with, the armed forces, a sporting giant like Collingwood Football Club? We hear a lot about culture in sporting organisations, the university sector, and now the cut and thrust of startups, of venture capital and global edtechs. They must be very different cultural settings in which to go that through line of a journey.
Undoubtedly they are different. I think there's a few different variations, but the obvious one is just the difference between the for-profit and the not-for-profit sectors. And in some ways, I actually feel that sometimes it's easier. It's easier in the for-profit sector. And what I mean by that is that the goal, the key metrics, and the critical or the most important stakeholder is always quite clear in the for-profit sector. Whereas you think about universities and sporting clubs, they have multiple stakeholders, multiple objectives, no real clarity of hierarchy between them, or it might shift depending on sentiment or community expectation. And that, I think, actually makes clarity of strategy, governance, decision making, those can often be more challenging because of that lack of clarity. And I think that sometimes drives some of those cultural differences. It makes leadership more challenging. It makes leadership need to be more relational, more political. And I don't necessarily mean it in a negative sense, but it just is. And you mentioned in the bio, I was fortunate to join the board of IDP Education when Seek first invested back in 2006, and it became effectively a joint venture between the 38 universities and Seek. And while there were many challenges on the way, one of the things that the Seek investment bought was that it allowed IDP in some ways to clarify its mission, because part of the investment, IDP had to move from being a not-for-profit entity to being a for-profit entity. And it was very clear now that it had a financially focused shareholder group that required IDP to become a commercially sustainable entity. And you know, you can argue the pros or cons, but what it did provide was clarity for the organization. And in some ways, I think that made quite a beneficial difference for providing that real clear goal of this is what IDP now needs to do. And but my experience in the military was a bit different. Definitely does have more hierarchical and traditional elements that is somewhat like a university. Although what I found with the military is there always was that clarity of mission and probably a bit of a stronger drive around collective outcomes. I think some universities are wonderful around their collective outcomes. Some universities are a little bit more individual or fragmented, but we could probably talk about those differences a bit more.
Yeah, that's a really nice way that you've described it, of that clarity of mission. I mean, we were just chatting before coming on with this interview about some of the leaders and institutions that impress us in other parts of the world. And I think you first mentioned two places that I've spent a lot of time studying and talking with and advocating for in Southern New Hampshire University and Western Governors University, and two leaders there in Paul LeBlanc and Scott Pulsifer. One thing that drives that strikes me about both those individual leaders is their clarity of purpose, is their focus in their mission, in, as you say, a sector that's much more open to multiple perspectives and governance in an environment of broad and diverse stakeholders. Has that been your experience of those two places particularly?
Yeah, look, obviously ours is more with Southern New Hampshire, and I think that's the great leadership that Paul and his team brought, was a real clarity of mission and with a purpose that was much more than making money. They have a real purpose around impacting, you know, tens of thousands and now hundreds of thousands of adults in the US and through one of our investments together now more globally. And that's, I think that's one of the toughest jobs for a vice chancellor, is providing a clarifying, a unifying vision that multiple disparate parts of a university with different agendas can all rally around, and it brings them together. And I think that, you know, Paul is a terrific example of having done that with his institution, and now having has had an incredible impact through his career.
He certainly has. And you've used the idea or the concept there of clarity and clarity of purpose. I wonder if I can probe about differences in this journey that you've had with that common thread line with another concept or maybe a related pair of concepts. And that is around risk appetite and the focus on opportunities more than threats in different leadership settings. I sometimes worry and wonder whether too many of our global universities have not enough appetite for risk and are too focused on the threats to their business rather than actively exploring and exploiting new opportunities. And wonder if your diverse experience of the sector, of the other places that we've described, and now with your focus in an investment business, I imagine appetite for risk and opportunity is what gets you up in the morning.
Yeah, look, I mean, absolutely. But I think it goes to the nature of the organisation and, you know, the startups or the earlier stage companies that we work toward, that we work with, they really have a growth focus, and they have to have a growth mindset within their organizations. But at the same time, they are high risk, and they're called high risk for a reason. You know, in startups, it's figurative. In the military, it's literal, that they can be life or death situations. That if they, you know, in the startup world, if you don't grow, there is a real chance that you will cease to exist as an organization. And I think that call, not necessarily a risk-seeking organization, but it is a risk-tolerant approach where the stakes are so high that it requires fast movement, it requires decision-making that takes on board that risk, accepts it and moves on because there's an opportunity to really grow the pie, and the downside can be so extreme. And my experience in the publicly funded university landscape is it's just a different environment where on one side, there's not necessarily always as much of a growth opportunity that they see. They don't necessarily view that there's as much chance to grow. And at the same time, there's not necessarily the life or death pressure that a startup has. There are threats, absolutely, but that real concept that this organization could cease to exist if we don't move forward probably isn't there. And I think that's not a criticism. It just leads to different cultures. It leads to different paces where one is, you know, go forward or there's real risk versus there's actually real risk in moving too far. And it just causes a difference in speed, in risk tolerance. You know, that said, I was fascinated. You had a podcast a couple of weeks ago where you had a VC from the UK on, who said that he thought there was a real potential that a publicly funded institution could actually go into default in the near future. And I found that quite extraordinary, and that's obviously very concerning, and potentially it actually results in and causes a changing culture, because all of a sudden the stakes go up and the status quo and protecting the current pie is not enough. And that's not necessarily a great way to get to that spot, but I do feel it's, at the end of the day, it's the incentives in the environment that causes those cultural differences.
So different contexts and environments between universities and other sorts of participants in the economy. But you've mentioned David Maguire of University of East Anglia was the podcast from a few weeks ago you were referring to there. And it makes me want to probe a little bit. I know I'm going to have the chance to explore this global dimension a lot more with Josh on stage in Melbourne when we're there, what will be tomorrow when this podcast comes out. But look, you've already said in your intro that you've had a range of experiences too. And I know that we both and Josh as well will be at the ASU and GSB summit next month in San Diego. I've always found that a fascinating place with university leaders, leaders of ed techs, investors, and others all coming together with a real focus on that appetites for opportunity and new ways of doing things. And to the extent that brokering deals is the focus rather than just listening to each other's conversations, it would seem. But I don't see a lot of Australian university leaders there. I've met some really interesting Australian ed tech leaders there. And I wonder if with the experience that you have, and as I say, I'll be intrigued to also ask this question of Josh tomorrow, how you see Australian universities and ed tech players are faring in the sort of global competition and ecosystem. What's the current landscape of Australian and global ed tech businesses looking like from that international comparative basis from where you sit in the world?
In many ways, Australia is a real leader, a world leader in education, particularly in higher education. Obviously, you know, the largest international student market on a per capita basis or as a percent of GDP, that's a great global success. It underpins a lot of the finances and the research for Australian universities. You've got the global success of IDP servicing the industry, not just in Australia, but now globally. I'm sure we'll talk about, you know, companies like OES and Go One and others later. So there are some great success stories. This should be the foundations and the building blocks. I think that, you know, the challenge for any, if I talk about startups or edtech first, the challenge for any Australian startup, the critical first decision is the Australian market alone going to be sufficient for them to build a decent business, or are they going to need to go offshore relatively quickly to get to scale? And I've seen that in several Australian companies, they think it's the former and then it turns out to be the latter. And that can be a terribly hard adjustment. It's a terribly hard pivot from a capital culture go-to-market perspective when they just realize the Australian market is not enough. Whereas those companies that are built to be global day one or have that embedded in their culture, they are just much more likely to be successful. And I think sometimes there are some Australian players, particularly in the education market, they see the size of the local market and they assume, well, this has got to be big enough for me to scale sufficiently. And unfortunately, it's not. It is for some. There are some great examples in the market. You know, I'm probably a little more at K-12, but, you know, and businesses like Edrollo, some of the information providers like the Compasses and the EHGs of the world, they've done really well. And the Australian market is likely big enough. But that need in general to look up and to be architecting the organization from day one to be international was very important. And then obviously for the university sector, like any sector, the sector has done well. It is highly competitive on a global basis and just never resting on those laurels and always looking and saying, yes, we might be ahead of these other, you know, destination markets, but here's the one thing they're doing really well and how can we learn from that and how can we not open up a weakness? Sometimes success itself can be its own weakness. And I think as long as the industry stays humble, as long as they travel, as long as they're curious, then they're already in a great position. And obviously the flip side is if you let that success breed complacency, then that is always the danger.
Yeah, fascinating hearing you describe the environment for startups and that in new business development dilemma of how quickly and if at all to go global, compared with a quite different consideration for the changing world of universities, where many, if not most of them, have been in business for some little while and have been quite locally focused with a bit of international onshore and a growing amount of onshore activity. But if you are starting a brand new university right now in Australia, you'd probably have more of the dilemma of the startup than you do of the existing conventional university. Would you comment on that?
Yes, obviously there haven't been many private universities or new universities established. Recently, I think where we have seen, you know, the relatively younger regional universities, it has been very challenging for them. It is more difficult for them to attract international students. I think some of them have actually done a fabulous job to try to promote their destination and gain the share that they have to convince a student in, whether it's from China or in India or Nepal to come and live in regional Australia. That is a huge barrier alone to overcome. And the fact that they've been able to do that is a real credit. But it is a challenge for them. I think, Torrens have done a really good job of building that organisation. I think Linda Brown's a fabulous CEO, but I'm sure that she could tell you all the myriad of challenges it is to try to establish a genuine university. And at the same time, I think the funding environment is so tough. There's a question of how much more competition do we really need in the space? I think we need more capacity, but do you necessarily need more competition? The marketing dollars really beneficial to the industry as a whole? They have to spend it. You see everywhere the amount of money spent by the public sector marketing all of these individual universities. Yet the net gain for the sector, I think, is a question. So I think the sector as a whole faces this real challenge where you need innovation that usually comes from newer players, but is more competition in total actually a positive thing or not? It's a fundamental question for policy settings and for individual vice chancellors.
If I look at your current partnerships, as I understand them, you've mentioned a couple of them there already. OES, which is now by any count an internationally successful OPM that's grown out of a university online venture merging with yourselves, with Seek. And you've mentioned Go One as well, which is a quite different business. It's a group of university graduates, some of whom I know very well, curating one of, I believe their marketing speak, and I believe the evidence of what I see objectively written about it. One of the most significant global learning content libraries from here in Australia. Dare I even say from here in Southeast Queensland in Logan. What a great success story. So there's two examples in that existing competitive environment of another venture maybe augmenting, if not competing, with current universities. And there's something in Go One, which is quite different, serving a partly university, but also very much a corporate and a lifelong learning need. Beyond those two, I'm sure there's lots of other things in your field of view. How are you seeing the opportunity, to the extent you can share with us, for your investments in Australian-based ventures to add to the existing competitive environment, and perhaps even more importantly, given what you said before, to compete globally in the higher education and lifelong learning market? Where's next for Seek Investments?
Look, thanks, Mark. Number one for us is really helping our current portfolio companies to maximise their potential over the next few years. We talked about OES. OES is a business that I'm personally very passionate about. I was lucky enough to work on the original business plan and then the original joint venture with Swinburne to found it. So to see it now more than a decade later, it's helped educate thousands of working adults for multiple universities. And I think on almost any student or financial metric, by far the most successful OPM in the world. We didn't even have that term when we first started it. We just saw an opportunity. And I think it's a great testament to what the private and the public sector can achieve when they work together. But it was started from a perspective, which is where the opportunity comes in, of where is there a problem to be solved, an open problem to be solved, rather than just competing in an undifferentiated way. OES's real specialty that I'm sure you're aware of is helping to educate working adults and other non-traditional university students that are just not the focus for a university. And OES is really an expert at that non-traditional student that just can't have access to the standard model. And it's a terrific win-win-win-win for the university, for the student, and for society, because you're allowing the university to open up effectively income streams and its societal impact, You're enabling those students to have access to education they otherwise wouldn't, and then society benefits. So that concept of solving a problem where multiple wins, growing the pie, is, I think, a great example of that's what edtechs need to do. Just solving the same problem or just doing the same thing. Well, that university has an online MBA, so I'm going to do an online MBA. That's not really helping to grow the pie. You're just competing for the same pie. I think where OES has come in and added that student base and added capabilities has really helped. And then I know that also you had Alex from Aston University on recently, and OES has just announced a long deal with Aston University, which we think will, you know, hopefully create a similar opportunity that for OES in the US in the UK. And that's where those growth opportunities come from, you know, whether it's for edtechs or service providers or even universities themselves, from saying where are those problems that haven't yet been solved. And a lot of our focus, therefore, is on trying to identify those problems and then identify those early stage companies that are trying to solve those problems. And, you know, I'm sure as any of your guests would say, there are myriad problems to be solved, and I'm a techno-optimist, so I believe that technology will play a key role in solving those problems.
Yeah, I think I'm a techno-optimist as well. I know Alex is. I know his cock-a-hoop at the moment. I don't know if you saw, but Aston University secured a major £11 million doctoral training centre overnight, and he can't contain his excitement and enthusiasm about it, and nor should he. And there's a man that, as a leader in Australia, but also now in the UK, has pioneered that sort of partnership model. And in my interview with him, you may have heard that he was particularly focused on building Aston's reputation in social mobility outcomes rather than conventional rankings. And with that in mind, I'd actually like to ask you a question or two, because I think you'd have a different perspective, I imagine you will, on something that's been a real preoccupation for leaders and commentators in the Australian university system for the last 16 months now. You're undoubtedly aware that we've had a final report on the Australian University's Accord process. It's been running 16 months. It's got some modelling behind it that I imagine you're aware of, arguing for a doubling of people with the skills over the next 25 years of what it's determined our economy is going to need, with an assumption that those skills will come from either TAFE or VET education or from universities. But given what you're doing, for instance, in Go One, I wonder what other alternatives you, from where you sit in Seek Investments, what other alternatives you would see for skill development for lifelong learners to meet the economy's future skills and talent needs that might be other than in certificates and degrees from TAFEs and universities, and whether, and if so, how that might be driving your investment plans and strategies as Seek Investments.
Look, thanks, Martin. It's one of the things we're incredibly focused on. I think one of the great promises of this next generation of artificial intelligence, of AI, one of the great promises that it has is to create genuine personalized learning journeys, not just for school-aged or school-leaver students, but most importantly for working adults, and to be able to create those journeys at scale at an affordable cost. That's almost the holy grail of the lifelong learning space, that you can assess and understand what skills a person needs to develop, and then you can develop a personal learning plan specifically addressing those skill needs with the content, the learning support, the assessment, all wrapped around in a seamless and, most importantly, cost-effective way. You can see that path. We're not there yet, but you can see a path towards that sort of outcome. If you talk to a lot of people in the HR space and the skill development space on the corporate side, there is a huge focus on skills now. It used to be on credentialing, which is where the universities of the TAFE plays. Their focus has really shifted much more to skills assessment, skills development, continuous skill development. And so that's where we do see a big opportunity. And I think the thing that we don't want to miss is the opportunity for the universities and the TAFEs that have great content, they have great credentialing, great experience. You don't want them to miss out on that journey because it doesn't quite yet fit the model. So I think where there's an opportunity to bring those together, almost every single one of our portfolio companies right across the globe is working on this path in one way or another, be it, you know, OES or Go One or the private universities we've invested in Brazil and Mexico and elsewhere. They can all see this pathway to real personalized learning journeys. And then I think the opportunity is for how does the public sector come along and contribute to that? That will take a bit of change, but it is a terrific opportunity and I think moves in the direction that society and most importantly working adults need, which is shorter continuous skill development as opposed to episodic long credentialing.
It's a bit of a shame that we gave our major review for the next 25 years the title The Australian Universities Accord in some ways, because it sort of prejudged and maybe it narrowed the focus of what we're looking at to think that let's put the problem to one side for 1 minute. The solution's got to have something to do with universities. And, you know, that lovely commentary you've just given there, I love the way that Paul LeBlanc and others, but Paul in Southern New Hampshire University has got such a fierce critique of the time-based university education model in contrast with, and I know it's a title that generates various reactions, a competency-based education model, which is focused on attainment and of skills and the measurement of them having been attained rather than grading what someone's achieved over a period of time, as being a much more fit for purpose way of a university getting in this space of developing the skills that workforces and employers of the future might need. You describe it as a portfolio approach. It sounds like you're spreading your risks and not putting all your eggs in one basket, that I certainly assume that there will be great growth in a learning economy of the future, but a growth in demand for skills more than there'll be growth in a demand for credentials and degrees. Am I right in thinking that Seek Investments is spreading its risk and putting its eggs in multiple baskets of universities, maybe, but non-university providers and pure technology players and players from all around the world as a means of the unknown winners of that future competition emerging? Is there a strategy as explicit and as specific as that behind what you're doing?
There is, in terms of, we have a number of investment theses in the education or future of learning space that we're pursuing. And I think that we wouldn't say it as stark as one or the other. We think it's both, and we think there's a development of both. We think that credentialing, teaching critical thinking, those teaching, you know, providing a foundation for research and basic research, the core elements of a university are absolutely critical. They are necessary, though not sufficient for a lifelong learning journey. And so how do you have those real knowledge-based thinking development credentialing experience and then add to it? How do you add to it those additional skill base? So it's not one or the other, it's both. And I think a great example is, you know, we have an investment in a group in Brazil called Allura that is IT-focused, and it combines both. It has two businesses. One is a premium private university, campus-based university. It also has off-campus students, but it's primarily a campus-based IT university. It is amazing. It's such energy. It's all very project-based learning, but it issues degrees and undergrad and postgraduate degrees. Coupled in that group is the leading non-accredited IT training content platform in Brazil in Portuguese. So you've got both elements. You've got the university providing the longer-term episodic credentialing and the foundations, and then you've got the Allura platform providing the very specific coding skills that someone needs in their job. And so I think that probably goes a bit more to our thesis of both, that both are required moving forward. And then underpinning that is a layer of software, and that's a bit more where our focus is Seek Investments is starting to move into the software players, the education technology software players that are developing the next generation of products to serve both higher, both post-secondary and K-12 institutions, particularly on how you create these personalized learning journeys, but how you make universities and institutions solve their problems. Some of those problems are around cost, Some of them are around effectiveness and some of them are around revenue. And there are myriad software players that are trying to solve all of those problems. And as much as it's a somewhat a dirty word, there is a need for cost efficiency in all of these institutions. They are under huge financial pressure, not their fault. They are under huge financial pressure. And the two ways to solve that is either to grow revenue or to reduce the costs. And we think there is a wonderful opportunity for technology to enable both of those things in a way that doesn't impact the learning outcomes and the quality of the student experience. And so that's what we're looking for. Who are those companies that are emerging that solve both the revenue and some of the cost challenges that institutions, both post-secondary and K-12, have? That's the additional arm to our thesis that we're working on adding.
Aren't we lucky to have in Australia a group like you that's so focused on doing that with the leading edge of Australian practice and is so globally connected to find it in Brazil, in Boston, I think you mentioned Mexico earlier, and I know that the company's been out with the people in Monterey and the Institute for the Future of Education, the work that Michael Fung has taken there from the groundbreaking work that he did in Singapore. So you've got your eye on the world from Australia and are looking at finding combinations of things that are going to solve tomorrow's problems and address the financial strain that we're under. And in doing so, you've spoken very positively about the state of Australia's universities, the competitiveness of our universities, and the importance of being humble. And in the work that I do and we do on HEDX, this need to look beyond our shores and beyond our sector for best practices to inspire the future has been really important to us. There's a question at the end of all of this somewhere, and that is along the lines of how aligned do you think what is happening in higher education in Australia currently is with the global best practice that you're monitoring? And what would your advice be to Australian leaders of universities and of Australian edtech companies with all the strengths that you've described of what we might be in danger of missing and what we should do to fill any awareness gaps and knowledge gaps that we have to prepare us for the future? Do you have some advice for us all on that?
It's always hesitant to offer advice on a big scale. I think, look, as we said, in many ways, the Australian higher education system is one of the best in the world, but there's a commonality, as we just talked about, that there are consistent challenges to institutions, whether they're in the US or Mexico or Southeast Asia or Australia, and that is they are genuinely revenue challenged. There is, outside of a very few markets, there is outside of India and a couple of others, there is decreasing school leavers. Demographics are poor in most countries, even including China. The demographics are poor of the school leaver market. There is increasing competition for international students, even though, again, outside of a few, most source countries are struggling with their demographics. And at the same time, there is this incredible pressure on costs as costs continue to rise. The cost of academic staff, the costs of research, the cost of serving students, providing them with the technology and the experience they want, and administrative and compliance costs just going up. That is a consistent challenge in almost every market we're at. There are different nuances, absolutely, very different nuances, but there is a consistency in those challenges. And so therefore, I think all universities need to constantly be looking at those new sources of revenue, importantly looking at ways to lower their costs so that they can invest in research, they can invest in infrastructure, they can invest in student experience. And the other commonality is there's very few governments that have a big spending agenda, particularly in education, likely over the next couple of years. And that's a shame, but that's a reality. So I think for the sector itself, and then for edtech companies, helping to solve those problems is on everybody's mind and is what we're looking for. I think from a university perspective, it's the leadership to be able to be honest about the problems internally, because that's hard sometimes because of the impact on morale, but being honest about those challenges and then being courageous enough to look outside for ideas, to travel, to talk to numerous different organisations, both within education and sometimes just outside of education. This is not the first industry to face these problems. This is not the first industry to have, you know, declining revenues and increasing costs and poor demographics impacting it. But to be open-minded, humble, willing to trial, willing to implement, not necessarily looking for the big bang solution, You know, it was the saying, don't look for the silver bullet, just look for lots of lead bullets. You know, it's better to better to fire a whole lot than take one shot. You know, so just that willingness to try. And I think that's the challenge, because we talked about that risk tolerant environment right at the start, and that the university's incentives and structure are not perfect for trial and error and implementing, and maybe even failing a little bit. So that's the, I think, the great challenges for the university leadership, is knowing they've got these challenges. How do they try different things? How do they create an environment that doesn't punish failure, that can try small scale things without getting their various stakeholder groups offside? That's not easy, but unfortunately, there's not that many alternatives other than sit there and have change happen around you and not be able to impact it.
Yeah, sitting there and having it happen around you doesn't sound like a good place to be to me. And so, look, Mike, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation, as I knew it would be, and when I was so thrilled to see that you were going to be on the podcast. I'll just move it to a close now, if I may, by, you know, inviting you to return to some of what you just said in that last question, perhaps. But I think you referred to yourself as a techno-optimist before. Love that expression. I might appropriately attribute and pinch that from you, if I might. Because I believe I'm one of those too. I feel we need more techno-optimism in our sector. And so what would your pitch be to the sector and to its leaders and to this high-performing Australian higher education system about how it best avoids having change happen to it and arms itself on the bus of techno-optimism for a journey to the destination that's in front of us?
I think that message that I said before is that willing to be courageous, because it is going to take courage for any leader, particularly a leader in a very, universities are so complex. They have so many stakeholder groups, so many different objectives to deal with. So that willingness to be courageous, but I am a techno-optimist. I'm also an optimist of the space. I've been very fortunate in my career to work with just wonderful leaders in this space, from the late Denise Bradley through to, you know, Ian Young, Linda Kay, and now Pascal at Swinburne, Linda Brown at Torrens, and then, you know, in the private sector serving at Cinello Shanassy at IDP, of course, Denise Pitt and Sue and the OES team, just remarkable. There are some wonderful people both in the public sector and the private sector focused on this space. And when you see these leaders, they're very thoughtful, they're very passionate, they believe in the power of technology to enable education, and they look openly to partner with others. They realise they don't have all the answers and that the world isn't zero sum. They realise that the world can be positive sum. And I think if we can have more people like that developing and moving into leadership positions in the sector in Australia, then you know, the future may not be easy, but it will end up, you know, being quite bright for both the sector and for Australia.
I think that's a great note to finish on, Mike. Thanks for calling out the great leaders we've had and those that we still have, and inviting our broader leadership to be courageous in the days ahead. Thanks very much for being our guest on HeadX today.
Oh, terrific. Thank you so much for having me, Martin. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Me too. And that's all we've got time for this week on HeadX.